the slippery slope toward nuclear war.
The big issue here is how you deal with minor aggression, because the human instinct is to deal with aggression by being aggression back. We want to look strong. We want to look tough. And so if somebody does something and we say, what the hell do you think you're doing? Look out, you're going to be in trouble. That's the sort of human response. And unfortunately, in international affairs, where very powerful weapons may be deployed within minutes, you can't act like that.
That's best-selling author Ken Follett talking about his new novel, Never. It's a chilling look about how a small international incident could lead to nuclear annihilation. Then, Anthony Horowitz delves deeper into what makes his character, Daniel Hawthorne, tick.
And I think part of the pleasure of writing these books is that with every book, I find out a little bit more about the horrible thing that may have happened a long, long time ago, but has caused Hawthorne to become such a very troubled and unhappy man. Actually, he's not a bad man. I mean, he's not a monster. He's somebody that I think you can like. And in the books, I notice that with every book I write, I seem to like him a little bit more. But that said, he is troubled, and the relationship between us is not an easy one. I think that's part of the pleasure of the read.
Horowitz tells us about the third in his meta-murder mystery Hawthorne series, A Line to Kill. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Every one of Ken Follett's many novels published after his 1979 breakout thriller Eye of the Needle have been huge bestsellers. And I'll bet Never, his new one published November 9th, will be one too, if the world wants to take the cautionary tale it spins seriously. Never is about how the world could slide down the slippery slope to nuclear war. The big interconnected crises we face, climate chaos, migration, and wars over oil, are the powder keg to the spark of a small incident on the border of Chad and Sudan. Thus begins a chain of events that bring in North Korea, China, and the U.S. in a terrifying game of chicken that bids fair to end very, very badly. Ken Follett is the author of nearly 50 books, including Pillars of the Earth and A Column of Fire. Ken Follett, welcome to Writer's Voice. This novel, Never, is about how the world could find itself on the brink of nuclear war. A lot of people don't think about nuclear war anymore. What led you to take this issue up?
Well, I think the situation has changed. We were worried about the Russians for many years, weren't we? And then in the 80s and 90s, we started to reduce the number of nuclear weapons that both sides had. And I think we got into a slightly false sense of security because we thought, well, the problem is being dealt with quite nicely. And of course, all those arms reduction talks have just fallen away. And we're now back in an arms race. And in particular, we have China to worry about. We always worried about the Russians, the Soviets as they were then. But we sort of figured out how to manage them. And we started even reducing the tensions. But that stopped now. And we have more nuclear weapons than ever, more nuclear countries than ever. And of course, we have China to deal with, which is just not as predictable and reasonable as the Russians. It's kind of surprising to think of the Russians as reasonable, but by comparison, they were. So I do think we probably don't worry enough about it.
Well, why do you say that China is less reasonable, less predictable? What leads you to think that?
I think it's only that we don't know them. We knew the Russians because we'd been dealing with them for so long, and we sort of knew how their system worked, we knew how they operated, and we were able to to have moderately reasonable negotiations with them. The Chinese are new. I mean, of course, they're not new. They're thousands of years old. But this Chinese government, in its present stance of aggression and ambition, is something we haven't come across before. And I don't think we're quite sure how to deal with it. And when you're not familiar with an aggressive nation like that, there's a danger that you'll misread the situation.
You make an allusion in the book to the fact that the West is fearful of losing its preeminence, losing its hegemony, basically, and the U.S. in particular is a world power. How much do you feel that our own fears, reasonable or not, may underlay some of the destabilizing influences that you explore in this novel, Never?
Well, I think that the big issue here is how you deal with minor aggression, because the human instinct is to deal with aggression by being aggression back. We want to look strong. We want to look tough. And so somebody does something and we say, what the hell do you think you're doing? Look out, you're going to be in trouble. That's the sort of human response. And unfortunately, in international affairs, where very powerful weapons may be deployed within minutes, you can't act like that. But when a national leader, a prime minister or a president, backs away from a conflict, it's often the wise decision, but it doesn't look good. And they get no thanks from the voters. The voters want their leaders to be tough guys who will show the others who's boss. And that kind of instinct, I'm making it sound kind of almost comic, but it's natural. It's a natural human instinct. And that's, I think, that's the biggest problem. You get a little conflict and somebody has got to say, look, let's not fight about this. Surely there's some way we can work this out. Somebody's got to say that. Well, really, both sides have to say that. But if you maintain I'm bigger than you type attitudes in international diplomacy, then a small problem can become a big problem and then a crisis, and it can, in the end, become a war.
Toxic masculinity, I believe, is one of the terms one can use that underlies that. You know, you and I are contemporaries, and I very well remember the Cuban Missile Crisis, in spite of the fact that I was a child then. And in fact, it led to an obsession with the fear of nuclear war. First of all, I wanted to ask you, did you have the same experience? I mean, I really remember the Cuban Missile Crisis.
No, I think I was too young to know how much danger we were in. And my wife, Barbara, who's a little bit older than I am, actually remembers going to sleep one night during that crisis, thinking I may never wake up. I wasn't old enough to have those kind of fears. I just, the idea of a nuclear war just wasn't, I didn't really understand it. I guess I was 12 or 13, and it was beyond me. Probably luckily for me that I didn't really understand how bad it was.
Yeah, we were both 13. I felt like your wife. But it's an example of exactly of what you were speaking of before, because JFK established a back channel with Nikita Khrushchev, and that is probably the only reason we did not incinerate the planet at that time. And of course, JFK was mightily hated by at least certain people in the military for his decision.
Yes, absolutely. I remember writing about the Cuban Missile Crisis in my book, Edge of Eternity. And there was a case where basically President Kennedy and his brother, because Bobby Kennedy was the person who actually operated the back channel, wasn't he? And between the two of them, they saved the world and they got very little thanks for it.
They both ended up assassinated, although I'm not going to make a link between one or the other. So in this book, in Never, without explicitly spelling it out, you draw the link between climate change, migration, and conflict over oil, and how these destabilize world security to the point of threatening nuclear war. Explain more about that.
Well, the spark in Never, the modern equivalent of the assassination in Sarajevo, is the death of an American soldier in Chad, in North Africa, a country called Chad in North Africa. And he's killed by a terrorist, but the terrorist is using a Chinese weapon, Chinese rifle. So that's the incident, tragic and moving, but minor. But that's the incident that begins to escalate. At the same time, there is a joint French and American effort to combat jihadism in North Africa. And one of the principal characters is a young Arab woman who's a widow with a child, and she lives on the shores of Lake Chad. Now, Lake Chad is the biggest oasis in North Africa, in the Sahara Desert. And 50 years ago, it was 10,000 square miles of water, and today it's 500 square miles. And so the millions of people who used to live on the shores of that lake are all finding themselves destitute and hungry. There isn't enough water to irrigate their crops. Their sheep can't find grazing, and the big fish that they used to live on in the lake are no longer there because the lake is too shallow. So one of these people, a woman called Kia, begins the journey across the Sahara Desert to go to Europe, because it's the only way she can think of to find a way of making a living and feeding her child. And what struck me was that journey that she makes is symbolic of the connection between Europe and the way we burn coal and oil and fill our cars with gas, and the climate change that is destroying the lake that has given her and her ancestors a way of life for many years. And I thought that was, you know, that it's almost as it's like drawing a line on a map, isn't it? The connection, the link holding the two things together. And it's ironic, isn't it, that we here in Europe feel that illegal immigration from Africa is such a terrible problem for us. And yet we're at least partly responsible for the problem because of our lifestyle.
Exactly. And as you also mention in this book, in Never, Chad has a huge amount of oil ready to be exploited, although hopefully that oil will stay on the ground if we are to survive as a civilization. So there is this conflict between Chad and Sudan, but behind it are the big powers.
Oh, yes. Yes, and the interest of United States, the European countries, and China, and North Korea, their interest in North Africa is great because of the raw materials. There's gold, of course, and oil, and cotton, everybody wants to make sure that they have some kind of control over these things. So there's conflict just over North African resources, but it's part of the sort of worldwide desire for major countries to increase their influence in places like North Africa. We want to have some power there so that access to those natural resources cannot be snatched away from them.
And China, of course, is a whole other threat in this book. You've already alluded to it, Ken Follett. In this novel, Never, there's the whole issue of China's attempt to establish its hegemony over the South China Sea in international waters because of potential oil development, at least in part. I don't think that's something most people hear about, but that's another example of this. And so talk about China and North Korea and the arms trade, these threads that come together in this novel.
Well, the arms business, manufacturing and selling arms all over the world, it was described to me as the only profitable business that North Korea has. And given that it's such a poor country, they, of course, will not be scrupulous about who they sell guns to. So, African jihadis get guns from them as well. So that's an important connection. But actually, the Chinese government has a concept of Greater China, and they want to bring it all together again. And it includes Hong Kong and Taiwan and several groups of islands in the South China Sea and, in fact, in the East China Sea as well, islands whose ownership is disputed. And now, it's obviously an arguable question whether these places that they're trying to, that they want to take over, are actually part of China or deserve their independence. And there's no answer to that. I mean, it's not a factual question. The people of Taiwan don't want to be part of communist China. And the Chinese government says, well, too bad, because you are part of China and you've got to put up with it. So there's an absolutely an insoluble problem. 10 years ago, when the Chinese government was a bit more willing to compromise, then something might have been worked out. And that's what everybody's been hoping for years. But now the Chinese have become intransigent. They've become very aggressive. It's like they're a bit like, you know, adolescent boys when they grow to 6 feet tall and realize they have these big muscles, these long legs, and they want to use them. And in a way, you know, now that China's got so wealthy and powerful, they want to flex their muscles. But it's very, very dangerous. What their actions seem to us to be aggressive. They say, we're never aggressive. We never attack anybody outside China. But Taiwan isn't outside China. And Hong Kong isn't outside China. And the South China Sea. So we see them as aggressive. They deny that they're aggressive. And there doesn't seem at the moment to be any room for compromise. And there's one other thing you've got to remember about China. And this was said to me again and again by people I consulted on China. They look back at the history of their relations with the West, and they call it the era of humiliation. And, you know, they're not wrong. I mean, some of us, notably the British, some of us behave in a very, very bad way towards China. I mean, the British, when the Chinese government tried to outlaw opium, which, of course, is the old-fashioned heroin, the Chinese government outlawed it. The British started a war to stop them because it was the British who were bringing the opium in and selling it. Now, that is a really shameful episode in the British past, although not many British people acknowledge that. But it's also a tremendous humiliation for the Chinese. And so they're very sensitive. They're very touchy. And anything that seems like the West bossing them around really makes them angry. So they are very difficult to deal with.
Of course, speaking as an American, I think you could argue that the U.S., is at least as aggressive as China. I was listening to Lawrence Wilkerson, who was a retired U.S. Army colonel, former chief of staff to Colin Powell. I heard him say that the purpose of the U.S. is to make war, that basically our foreign policy is driven by our military-industrial complex and the money, you know, kind of the legal arms trade, not the illegal arms trade. And this also is a huge contributor to the kind of destabilization that you speak about in this book. And yet you portray the U.S., I think, with a little bit rosier hue than might be deserved.
Well, I get your point. And I know that there have been times when the U.S. has been a destabilizing influence. But overall, I feel, and I think most people in Europe feel, that there was something reassuring about being an ally of the US and knowing that the most powerful country in the world was also the flagship of democracy. So we were kind of, there was this tremendous power just across the Atlantic that could be relied upon to be on the side of freedom. And I think that feeling has always been more important than all the complaints that Europeans have long had about the things that the US does. Those things are irritations, the kind of irritation that you get when there's a member of your family that you love, but sometimes he misbehaves. That's the kind of, you might have a brother or something, or a cousin who you're fond of and you love him. But now and again, he does things that makes you think, oh, goodness, why on earth? Here he goes again. Why on earth is he doing that? So I mean, that's my feeling about it, that there was, despite all the complaining that we've done about the US over the decades, the fact that the US was powerful and democratic was always a sort of ultimate reassurance for us.
Well, of course, that democracy is hanging by a thread. You know, we have a huge assault on democracy by the Republican Party. You have a Trump-like character in the book.
Yeah.
But the president is a moderate Republican. I have to say this is actually a critically endangered species in U.S. politics these days. I doubt if someone like Pauline Green could become a president as a Republican, as the GOP, the party is today. But I think the larger point is that, you know, a lot of people thought, including General Milley and Nancy Pelosi, feared that Trump would launch nukes. But this book is kind of a cautionary tale in that I think it points out that it doesn't take an extremist like Trump to get close to nuclear war.
Well, no. Of course, there's more than one way that we could get involved in a nuclear war, and one would be by re-electing Trump as president. There have been several incidents in which a flock of geese has been mistaken for a missile launch by the watching stations, both in the US and in the Soviet Union. And the alarms have been rung and the missiles have been ready to retaliate. An accidental start to a nuclear war is perfectly possible. And what happens in Never, in which reasonable people actually bring the world to the brink of nuclear war, is a third way. Of course, the other ways, I've got to look at this from a literary point of view, Francesca. And if a crazy president orders a nuclear attack, that's not a novel. It's too short. It just happens. And really the same thing about the flock of birds that's mistaken for missiles, because that's all over in 5 minutes. But the way that we approach danger in Never is gradually and through diplomatic and military moves that look sensible but turn out to be more dangerous than they seemed. And that of course, there's enough, as it were, interest and drama in that process to make a novel. So to some extent, you know, it may well be that there's much more danger from a crazy president than from a sequence of events. But a crazy president doesn't make a novel.
And this is a terrific novel. You know, I wanted to ask you one final question in the few minutes we have left. As the crisis unfolds in the novel, Never, the threat becomes increasingly apparent to many of its characters. Yet there almost seems to be a fatalism in their reaction, which I actually found to be quite realistic, because I think people do take a fatalistic view of this enormity. And I had to ask myself why. I mean, in a world where, as you point out, new nukes are being developed and built, the threat is only getting larger, why isn't there more outrage, more push to ban these world-destroying weapons? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it just reminds me of all the years that I used to smoke cigarettes. And I knew that they could kill. I smoked for 20 years from the age of 14 for the next 20 years. I smoked cigarettes regularly and I loved tobacco. I really enjoyed it. And now I notice that the people of my generation who die first are the smokers. It's absolutely tragic, you know, and But I think, so your question, the fatalistic attitude, you're right, it doesn't make sense, but it's very human. Somehow we humans, and I guess it's like, I do think that nearly all American voters must have realized how dangerous Donald Trump was. He was crazy, he was irrational, he told lies. Even people who supported him must have known that, and yet they sort of seem to feel, yeah, but he's I don't know what, he's on our side, or he's one of us, or something like that. And so they allowed the whole country to be endangered because there was something about this guy that made them feel he was one of us. There we are. That's the kind of thing. We're human beings, aren't we? And we're not always rational.
A fatal flaw could be.
Yeah.
As you show in this novel, I mean, I think it's unique in many ways, or certainly in the maybe for many decades, this kind of unfolding of the examination of how we can destroy ourselves. And it's a terrific read. I mean, it's a page turner. Ken Follett, I want to thank you so much for talking with us on Writer's Voice about Never.
Thank you, Francesca. It's been a pleasure for me.
Ken Follett. Read an excerpt from Never by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, A Murder on a Small British Island has author Anthony Horowitz guessing at whodunit. Find out why after the break.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
That was Love That Bomb by Dr. Strangelove and the Fallouts from 1964. Best-selling maven of murder mysteries, Anthony Horowitz, is back with us today to talk about his new novel, A Line to Kill. It's the third in the Daniel Hawthorne series, where the author himself becomes a character in his own novels, serving as Watson to Hawthorne's Sherlock Holmes. The others in the series are The Word is Murder and The Sentence is Death. In the earlier books, Hawthorne was an enigmatic character. Now, in the new one, his character finally begins to become more transparent as he ferrets out the murderer. But the real delight is to follow Horowitz as he continues as first-person narrator of the series. It's a delicious meta-musing on the nature of mystery writing, including witty allusions to the greats of the genre like Agatha Christie and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. And with his sly references to his own shortcomings, Horowitz provokes chuckles as the novel's other characters cast doubt on his competence. It's entertainment in the highest sense of the term. Anthony Horowitz is the best-selling author of, among many others, Magpie Murders, House of Silk, Moriarty, and the Alex Rider series, as well as the TV crime dramas Foyle's War and Midsummer Murders. Well, Anthony Horowitz, welcome back to Writer's Voice. It's so great to talk with you again.
It's a pleasure to speak to you again, Francesca. Thank you for having me back.
So, A Line to Kill. This is the third Daniel Hawthorne mystery, after the word is murder and the sentence is death. Nice little plays on words there. First of all, A Line to Kill, give us a little hint about the title.
Well, the line in question is a power line that is cutting across the island of Alderney, which is a tiny island just off the coast of England to the south. And it also, of course, refers to the lines you might find in a book, because all three mysteries have a sort of a literary connection. And this one does take place during a literary festival on the island. But it is an island divided because there are people who want the power line and there are people who don't want the power line. And it seems that as a result of this argument, murder has happened.
And I can certainly understand the sentiment. People are certainly willing to kill over things like that, or...
Oh, particularly a small community, and Alderney, the island, is only 3.5 miles long. I mean, it's a tiny place, and you can imagine, I've only visited the place once myself, but you can imagine that an argument like this is really going to tear a community in half. In fact, I'm talking to you from a country where, you know, we're still sort of fighting each other over the last huge decision we had to make about Europe. So, I mean, it is interesting how big decisions can tear communities to pieces.
Absolutely. And this island is interesting. You know, until recently, I really didn't know anything about the Channel Islands and how they had been occupied by the Nazis, by the German army in World War II. Just tell us a little bit about that.
It is absolutely fascinating that Jersey, Guernsey and Alderney were all invaded by the Nazis at the beginning of the war, and they hoped to launch the Operation Sea Lion, which was the invasion of the English mainland, from there, although that never in fact happened. But Alderney is a fascinating place for that reason. In fact, it was invaded twice, or rather it was defended twice, because in the time of Queen Victoria, they had a great fear that Napoleon was going to invade, so they built all these extraordinary Victorian fortresses all over the island. And as soon as the Germans arrived, they started building fortresses as well. And none of these fortresses were ever used because Alderney was never actually, there was never any counterattack, but they're still there. And everywhere you go, I think there are 62 of them on this island. Everywhere you look, there are these extraordinary monuments to warfare and to inhumanity there for all time.
What were they building? What was...
Fortresses. I mean, you know, the Odeon, for example, is an extraordinary Nazi fortress, which appears in the book. It stands above one of the places where a murder takes place in the story. But it is the most extraordinary building you've ever seen, straight out of Star Wars. And, you know, so sinister. Everywhere you look in Alderney, there are reminders of the war. It actually had three labor camps built there, concentration camps, where many, many people died. The number is disputed even to this day. But Silt was the most famous of it. And at least 700 poor souls ended their lives, worked to death inside Silt. And the islanders in Alderney are, I won't say they're ashamed of their past, and it's not as if they're to blame, but nonetheless, I do think that it casts a shadow even over the island today.
And then Daniel Hawthorne, of course, this is another mystery with him. The last time we talked, you said that you would reveal more about him in your next book, that being this one. Tell us a bit about Daniel. He is Hawthorne, we should call him. He is a retired DI who resigned under a cloud from Scotland Yard. Is that right?
That is correct, yes. I mean, what happened was he arrested a pornographer, a very unpleasant man called Derek Abbott, who by chance lives in Alderney. And after Abbott had been arrested, he fell down a flight of stairs, and Hawthorne was accused of pushing him, and that was the reason why he left the force. And this has been a mystery which has sort of hovered over the first two books. And now we move to Alderney, and I actually meet this character, Derek Abbott, who is, I have to say, an extremely unpleasant individual and the prime suspect in the murder that takes place. But he is connected in some way to Hawthorne's past. And I think part of the pleasure of writing these books is that with every book, I find out a little bit more about the horrible thing that may have happened a long, long time ago, but has caused Hawthorne to become such a very troubled and unhappy man.
So already, you know, I can imagine some of our listeners saying, wait, is this a true crime story or is this real? Because you're talking about meeting this character. Have you already figured out everything about Daniel Hawthorne, or is he unfolding for you as a character?
Well, Francesca, the truth of the matter is that I probably know about 70% of it, but I've deliberately not thought too much about it because I want that sort of sense of exploration. You know, the funny thing is that when I write a book like the Alex Rider books, for example, of which there are 14 now, with every book that I've written, I've found out a little bit more about this character that I've created, this teenage spy, about his feelings, his emotions, his history, the people who knew him and everything about him, really. And the same is happening with Hawthorne. The more I write about him, the more I sort of know him and get to know him. And therefore, I'm enjoying that process rather than having written down in a book all the answers to all the questions that revolve around him. And I want to say to your listeners, incidentally, that I've described him in quite disparaging terms. If Hawthorne was here with me now, I'm sure he'd be quite upset. But actually, he's not a bad man. I mean, he's not a monster. He's somebody that I think you can like. And in the books, I notice that with every book I write, I seem to like him a little bit more. But that said, he is troubled and the relationship between us is not an easy one. I think that's part of the pleasure of the read.
Oh, it absolutely is. And, you know, you, of course, are the Watson to Daniel Hawthorne's Sherlock. And I found it, you know, this is kind of metafiction because you're writing about writing a book. You know, the book in question is the one that you're actually researching in the book. But you as a character come in for a fair amount of, shall we say, taking down a peg by Hawthorne and the other characters. You know, that's a little bit tongue in cheek. But you present yourself as a second-rate writer, which I'd say is anything but the truth. Why that angle on you as a character?
Well, you're very kind, Francesca. Thank you for those nice things you said amongst that in that question. When I first pitched the idea of being the narrator in this book, you know, actually appearing myself, my publishers were very nervous that I would use it as a sort of an ego trip, that I'd be sort of promoting myself and sort of saying how, you know, clever I am and all the rest of it. But actually, that's not how I see myself. The Anthony in the book is much more, you know, I'm very proud of the work I do as a writer, but I don't think of myself as being, you know, somebody who is that brilliant. And if I was sucked into the world of murder, I would be the last person to guess who did it. In fact, when I read Agatha Christie or any of the great murder mystery writers, it's very, very rare that I'll actually guess the ending. So I'm not that clever when it comes to that sort of thinking. And that is how I portray myself in the book. I am five steps behind Hawthorne, always worried that he won't solve the murder, because if he doesn't solve it, I won't have a book to write. I need the solution. And as for the sort of, you know, the unfortunate things that happened to me in this book, the way people treat me, I guess it's done with a sort of tongue in cheek, with a sort of a smile. I'm not complaining about my life, but I am somebody who is not put upon, but shall we say, you know, I am not somebody who sort of walks into the room and owns it.
You are modest indeed.
Well, no, I just, you know, it is a version of me. It's a version of my me at my best and me at my worst, me at my cleverest and me at my most sort of ineffective. And I do like the fact that in at least two of the books I've managed to get stabbed, and in all three books I make terrible mistakes and say the wrong thing at the wrong time. And it just chimes in. If you knew me, you know, as my wife and my children know me, they'd be completely understanding what that is. They say, oh yeah, that's how Dad is, or that's how my, you know, that's how I am. It is how my family sort of sees me in a way. But it's all done, you know, the whole thing is it's done with a smile. But these books are there to be enjoyed, they're entertainments, and everything is done just with a sort of a certain amount of tongue in cheek and a lot of humor.
Absolutely. I laughed out loud at many parts in this book. And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Anthony Horowitz about his latest in the Daniel Hawthorne series, A Line to Kill. Yes, you know, it's interesting that you say that you're like five steps behind him. You know, I found that I guessed whodunit fairly early in the book, but not with any sense of, you know, it was more like I guessed. I didn't know whodunit. And I felt that it was more because as I've read these books, the suspense was still there because I wasn't sure who'd done it and I wanted to see, you know, of course I had to read to the end. But the more I've read these books, it's almost as if I've absorbed unconsciously because I can't point to any one thing, but I've absorbed unconsciously a bit about how you think. So it makes it easier for me to guess. And I wanted to ask you, how is the process of throwing in all the red herrings that you have to throw in to throw the reader off the track?
Well, first of all, Francesca, I have to say I'm sort of mortified and shocked, and I'm going to have to very much think about my next book, number 4 in the series, to make sure that I actually fool you, because one of the first things I ask people when they read my books is, did you guess? And when they say, yes, they did, although there is a certain amount of pleasure in guessing a whodunit, I think, I at the same time am horrified because it's the very last thing that I want. Indeed, when I write the books, I show them to my wife, first of all, and to my family, and if anybody in the family guesses the ending, I will rewrite to take away the clue that actually gave away the identity of the killer. So the fact that you know me well enough by now, and it is we have spoken before, and I guess you know you are very intimate with my work. It does mean I'm going to have to start thinking up different motivation and different villains for my piece, for my writing. In terms of how I do it, I mean, you know, for me, what interests me is motive. I always say that murder mysteries are not about murder, they're about character. So I'm interested in the characters, the reasons why they become so angry or so frightened or so demanding or whatever it may be, that they will actually go as far as murder. And I suppose I'm also always trying to make sure that it is the least likely suspect. I will say within A Line to Kill, a great many people who read it have actually been fooled and have gone to the wrong person, and that wrong person was exactly the person I hoped they would go to. So it's difficult, isn't it, to talk about murder mysteries without giving anything away. But, you know, I'm going to have to think about the question you've just put to me. How do I do it, and how can I do it differently so I can fool you next time? For those of you listening, I should say that Francesca has very kindly agreed to cut a small part of this interview because between us, we sort of gave away the ending. But at the same time, she's made the very astute observation that there is a certain characteristic I give my killers, which I must remove from future books.
That's great. And, you know, talking about character, back to Hawthorne, you definitely flesh him out more in this book. And he becomes more of a kind of, let's say, a morally problematic. I mean, he's a nice guy. I do like him. I mean, he's not a nice guy, but he's an attractive personality. Let's put it that way. But I was questioning a little bit about, you know, his moral ambivalence, because on the one hand, you know, he has a very strong moral sense. And on the other hand, he seems to lack a little bit in compassion. That's like not his business. Is that right?
I think you sum up very well, actually. Yes, he lacks empathy. He lacks sort of the human touch, if you like. He is a very distant sort of person. I think with every book, instantly, he is becoming warmer and nicer. And I'm liking him more and more the more I write about him and the more cases that I accompany him on. But I think he is also a highly moralistic person. And one of the pleasures of this book for me is the solution where the killer says, look, the villain, the victim deserved to die. What point is there in pursuing me? And his view is my job as a detective is to unmask and to have arrested the killer. And that is you. There is no two ways about it. And I find that really interesting. You know, in the course of the book, when he's giving a lecture at the Alderney Literary Festival, he's asked, what is the nature of being a detective? Why do you do this job? And I think his answer is an interesting one, that, you know, he is partly the moral crusader, but at the end of the day, he's quite pragmatic about it. A crime is committed, a detective is called in, the crime has to be solved. Those are the rules. He won't break them.
We're talking with Anthony Horowitz about his latest in the Daniel Hawthorne series, A Line to Kill. And then there's a kind of minor character, but a very interesting one, who is a psychic. She's a medium. And she's, you know, treated as a fraud in the book. On the other hand, Daniel Hawthorne does indicate he believes in ghosts. Is that a belief that you share?
Let me say I'm open-minded. I don't believe, I think, generally in the sort of ability to communicate with the other side, as it were. I don't necessarily believe in sort of specters wandering through walls holding their heads in their hands. But I think as a writer, I'm open to all possibilities. And therefore, to say cold-bloodedly there is no such thing as a ghost is to close certain doors, whereas just keeping the possibility open is, I think, more interesting. So when it comes to sort of religious matters or to supernatural matters or to the belief that there is anything in this world that we don't understand and that is perhaps larger than our comprehension can grasp is a good way to approach life, to embrace every possibility and to close the door to nothing.
Well, I agree with you there. Once a long, long time ago, I interviewed a journalist who wrote a whole book about, you know, supernatural beings. You know, he had come to it with, you know, journalistic, you know, what's the word?
Cynicism, cold-bloodedness.
Exactly, except that for the fact that when he was a child, he lived in a haunted house.
Well, I often tell a story of when I visited the bridge on the River Kwai. And my wife and I were down below the bridge, and once a week they would run a steam train over the bridge to commemorate, you know, the terrible atrocities committed by the Japanese in the Second World War. And we were underneath the bridge when we heard the train arriving, and we heard the steam, we both heard it, and we felt the bridge vibrating, and we ran up the bank quite a long way to get to the railway in time to see the steam train. And when we got there, we discovered that it wasn't coming that day. There was no steam train, but we had both heard it. We had both felt it. We had both almost smelt it. And to this very day, I wonder if we weren't in some way, because it was two of us, it wasn't just me, whether we weren't in some way visited by some kind of spectral memory, some ghostly memory of what had happened all those years before, and whether, you know, we hadn't experienced, if you like, at least in audio, a ghost.
Wow. Well, that's quite a story. And talking about stories, you know, as I said before, this is metafiction, A Line to Kill, where you're really not only putting yourself in as the character and not only talking about the very book that you're writing, but you write a lot about the process of writing. And one intriguing point that caught my attention was a paradox you talk about. You say that writers write words, some 10 million in your case, but are surrounded by silence. And you say that that causes you a sense of disconnection. I just wanted to ask you to talk more, a little bit more about that.
Well, yes, it is a sort of, I'm fascinated in the sort of the world of the writer because I have inhabited it now full time for over 30 years. And it is interesting that all the time I'm writing dialogue and I'm hearing voices, I'm meeting people, and I'm, you know, I'm surrounded by Hawthorne and Le Mesurier, by the medium, by all the other characters in this book and all the other books that I write. Alex Rider is there, and James Bond. I've just finished a James Bond novel, so he's been very much in my life. And yet I am entirely alone. And we're talking a moment ago about ghosts and phantoms, and it is this as if sometimes I am the only living person in a room that is full of phantoms and voices and such. And there is a strange paradox in that. You know, it's one of the reasons why, for me, the lockdown, the last 2 years of COVID have been very, very difficult to live through, because I've been not only isolated, but I've been isolated in an isolated world, as it were. So sort of two tiers between me and humanity. And that has been difficult to take, to be honest. But it does interest me that, you know, words are my bread and butter. They are my life. They are, you know, sentence construction, you know, language, dialogue, all of it. And yet it all happens in an empty room where I am the only inhabitant. And that was the observation I made.
Hmm. How did you cope with the sense of isolation during this pandemic?
Well, my stress levels were so high. My wife went out and got me a dog to keep me company. The dog managed to double my stress levels by being so difficult. He's sitting in the room now looking at me with very dog-like eyes and saying, why are you talking about me in such a disparaging way? But, you know, I worked very, very hard. I read, I mean, you know, books and reading and stories and writing have always been my life, they were all the more valuable, all the more of a lifeline during these last 2 years. As you know, at the end of the day, I could literally at the end of the day go to bed with a book, with, you know, with a great classic from the 19th century or a murder mystery, you know, more contemporary, or with all sorts of different books, and lose myself in that world. But I have to be honest and say I've had a tough 2 years. You know, I shouldn't say it because I know there are many people in the world who've had a much worse time than me, but I would be lying if I said I had enjoyed it.
Right. And, you know, talking about some of the Sherlock Holmes, talking about James Bond, I mean, you have 4 series that are ongoing at this time. Is that right? The Sherlock Holmes, James Bond. Then there's a Susan Ryland series with Magpie Murders and Moonflower Murders we've talked with you about. And I have a feeling that there's another one in the Detective Hawthorne series.
Well, certainly. I mean, first of all, Francesca, I must tell you that we've just finished filming Magpie Murders with the wonderful Leslie Manville playing Susan. And I've seen all 6 episodes pretty much in their final cut. And I can't tell you how excited I am about them and how well I think they've been done. Directed by Peter Cattaneo, who all those years ago did the full... was it the full Monty that he did? Yes, it was. And he's an absolutely wonderful director and has made a really great job of it. That will be out with PBS next year. And you're right, there are, you know, I'm going to do a third story with Susan Ryland probably next year or the year after. I have finished my third James Bond. I suspect that is my last. Sherlock Holmes is still with me, definitely. It's rather wonderful to be able to go from sort of book to book, character to character, world to world. It certainly keeps me on my toes.
Do you complete one book before you start the other one, or are you kind of dipping in a different series at the same time?
I can often write a TV show at the same time as I'm writing a novel, more or less, but I generally only work on one project in a day. So I won't, for example, do... you know, television in the morning and then jump back into Magpie Murders or whatever in the afternoon. I have to stick within the sort of, you know, that day's work. And I don't do 2 novels at the same time ever, no. Because when I'm writing a novel, it's an act of total absorption into that world. It's sort of, it's I'm living and breathing and dreaming that world, not just when I'm at my desk, but also when I'm out walking, when I'm, you know, just relaxing, when I'm sitting in the garden, whatever I might be doing, I am thinking and living in that world. And it would be impossible to divide myself between two books, and so I never have.
And so Magpie Murders, is that going to be on Master?
It's PBS, Masterpiece Theatre, yes, I think so.
That's great. And when doing these books, I mean, you know, the fiction about A Line to Kill and the other Daniel Hawthorne series is that they're true crime. But I wanted to ask you, have you ever actually seen a murdered body?
I have seen... a suicide victim, and I have seen a man. I have seen people who have. I have seen dead bodies. Yes, I have not. Have I seen a murder victim? No, I have never seen a victim of a murder. But you know that I said earlier when I was talking to you that murder stories are not about murder, and I think it's quite important that when I write one of my murder mysteries, I'm not lingering on the sort of, you know, yes, obviously one has to have the forensics, one has to have the police doctor who comes in with, you know, the report on how and when and all the rest of it, but I'm not personally interested in the sort of the gore of it, the sort of the viscera, the blood and the rest of it. I'm not writing books to disgust or to horrify. Murder is an excuse for exploration of character and community. And I get over with it as quickly as possible. You know, when the character in my book is murdered in A Line to Kill, the first murder, you know, certain things have to be described because they are relevant to the plot and to the clues. But I'm not that interested in sort of making people feel, you know, oh, that's gross when they read the description.
Yes. I guess I asked the question because there's at one point where you as the character talk about the horror of the murdered body. And so it was the first time it even came to my mind. Gee, I wonder if he's ever actually seen a murdered body.
I have actually been to an autopsy. I have sat in a morgue and watched a body being reduced to all its constituent parts, and have held a human brain in my hands to, you know, with the mortician or whoever, the doctor, whatever he was, telling me, you know, what he was looking at and the different colors and what this signified and everything. And I was quite proud of myself to have actually, you know, to have gone through that. And that was research for a TV show I was writing. But as I say, I don't take a great deal of interest in blood and death. I mean, it's an interesting paradox, if you like, another paradox, that we read these stories as entertainments, but they're based on something which is the exact opposite of entertaining. You know, when one person kills another person, they're committing a really terrible crime. And death is never, or very seldom, something to smile about. It is always something which is, you know, going to shock us. And that is not the aim of my books. You know, talking about Alderney and the labor camps and the concentration camps that were built on that island, they're mentioned in the book. But I had to be very, very careful to make sure that terrible dark shadow of Nazism and what happened in 1940 through to 45 shouldn't spoil the read, shouldn't take away from the pleasure and the entertainment of a mystery.
And as I think I said before, I had a sense that the next one in the Daniel Hawthorne, you know, there's going to be a next one. Have you already started to work on that?
I have, yes. I've started to think about it. I know who's killed and I know why they're killed. And I know the murder weapon. And I am beginning to think now about the world in which this person lives, which is actually the world of theatre this time. It's largely the background for the next book. I will start writing it probably in about 2 months' time.
Oh, well, I look forward to reading that, and I definitely look forward to watching the Magpie Murders on TV. That ought to be wonderful. Anthony Horowitz, as always, it's been a delight to talk with you. Thank you so much for telling us about your latest, A Line to Kill.
Francesca, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Anthony Horowitz. Go to writersvoice.net to hear our other interviews with Anthony Horowitz about the previous novels in the series. Next week on Writer's Voice, we spend the hour talking with David Talbot about the radical changemakers of the 1960s and 70s. His book, co-written with his sister Margaret Talbot, is By the Light of Burning Dreams. And we have a little time left. So here is a poem by my favorite poet, Mary Oliver. I've been reading her last poetry volume, Evidence, and I continue to be surprised and delighted by nearly every poem in this book. But here's a nice one on this autumn day that reminds us to pay attention to the trees, which I've been doing as I watch them lose their leaves for the winter. So here it is, The Trees by Mary Oliver. The trees. Do you think of them as decoration? Think again. Here are maples flashing, and here are the oaks holding on all winter to their dry leaves. And here are the pines, who will never fail, until death, the instruction to be green. And here are the willows, the first to pronounce a new year. May I invite you to revise your thoughts about them? Oh, Lord, how we are all for invention and advancement. But I think it would do us good if we would think about these brothers and sisters quietly and deeply. The trees, just holding on to the old holy ways. That was Mary Oliver, the poem The Trees, from her last collection, Evidence. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.